This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for tuning in. You've probably heard the saying, even paranoids have real enemies. That's from the poet Delmore Schwartz, who was both clinically paranoid and absolutely onto something. My guest today is Michael Shermer, the founder of Skeptic Magazine, a Substack superstar, and author of many best-selling books about rationalism, the evolution of morality, and pseudoscience. He quotes Schwartz in his latest book, Conspiracy, Why the Rational Believe the Irrational, to drive home the point that big world-changing secret plots happen all the time. But there are reliable ways for us to decide whether, for instance, Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, 9/11 was an inside job, or vaccines cause autism. For the record, Shermer says yes, no, and no on those counts. We talk about whether conspiracy thinking is on the rise, whether it's coded left or right, how wokeness poisons science, and whether the re-election of Donald Trump means free thought is ascendant. This interview was taped at a live event in New York City in January. Here is The Reason Interview with Michael Shermer. This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. All right, happy 2025 to everybody. Tonight we are talking with Michael Shermer. He has a phenomenal Substack that you can dig up called Skeptic. He's the founder and head of Skeptic Magazine, and there are copies of that scattered around. Please take a look at that.
These did make it, so they weren't.
All right.
That's telling.
So that's, my theory is coming together already.
That's right.
All I need is a lone gunman and a grassy knoll, and then I'll get back to you. His most recent book is Conspiracy, Why the Rational Believe the Irrational, which came out in 2022. And, you know, Michael, the first thing that I want to ask about I want to ask you, you know, as we talk about your book Conspiracy, but also articles that you've been posting at Substack as well as in Skeptic and elsewhere over the past couple of months about, you know, what seems to be a kind of the high watermark of wokeness seems to have crested and is, you know, is ebbing away. Do you want to take a victory lap regarding Scientific American? And explain, what was your relationship to Scientific American?
Yeah, I don't want to take a victory lap. I mean, just things happen as they do. And I didn't have anything to do with that. I'll give you the backdrop to that, what I'm talking about. So I started my monthly column in April of 2001. And so my goal was to write 300 consecutive monthly columns to match the great Stephen Jay Gould's 300 that he did in Natural History Magazine, and I made it to 214. And it was the last, they let me write on anything I wanted, including going after religion and stuff and the supernatural. But it was really when I approached subjects that became, I don't know, politically sensitive, I guess.
What's, for instance?
For example, column number 212 was the fallacy of excluded exception. So I opened with just a fun story about how I was a talking head on a documentary film about cursed horror films like The Exorcist and The Omen, where it's a horror film and then bad things happen on the set or people are killed, bad things happen to the actors or almost happen to the actors and so on and so forth. So then I said, just picture a 2x2 grid where you have four cells, and these are the cursed horror films. What about the cursed non-horror films? What about the horror films that are not cursed? And then, you know, the fourth one has nothing to do with it. And the producers are like, we don't really have a documentary then because there's nothing to discuss. Like, right. No. And they actually included that in there. Anyway, I said, well, that's kind of a lighthearted subject. So I said, let's take a more serious topic. Abusive parents who were themselves abused as children. So this is a hypothesis that psychologists float. Maybe the reason parents abuse their children is because they themselves were abused. All right, there's cell one. What about all the abusive parents who were never abused as children? They were raised in a loving family. What about the abused children who grew up to be loving parents who would never dream of abusing their children because they know how bad it is, right? Anyway, so the editor said, oh, no, you're excusing sexual violence against children, and you're saying it's not that bad. I said, I'm not saying it's not that bad. I'm just saying we want to know what the cause is, right? So I had to rewrite it and drop in a different subject, like psychics or something dumb. Mm-hmm. And then so the second to the last one was on race. And basically it was called Dreams Deferred. So I started with Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, and then what's happened to the dream? Well, it's gone great so far, all the way up until DEI and the anti-racism and wokeness and all that stuff. And it seems like if you listen to commentators today, it's never been worse. You know, Dr. King's dream is dead. You know, we are more racist than ever. And then I said, but look at the charts, look at the graphs, look at the data. Now, mind you, I only get one page, right? So it's like, here are the books you should read. And so the editor said, we absolutely can't run this at all. You're saying there's no problems, everything is great, and minorities have nothing to whine about. Like, that's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It's like you can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? Things are better than they've ever been, and there's still problems. And that was rejected completely. So then I thought, I think I'm going to get my walk-in papers here. And sure enough, a month later, that was the end of that. So anyway, the sign there is hypersensitivity to harm of readers. Like the readers will be harmed or offended or something like that. Something that we wouldn't have dreamed about being terribly worried about 10 years before.
Well, and you know, the editor of Scientific American, Laura Helmuth, was given her walking papers because of tweets basically related to the election. Can you talk a little bit about that and how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so she was hired after I left. The editor-in-chief before that was Marriott DeChristina, who was not woke at all. And so Laura just kind of shifted the content more and more toward woke DEI-type content. Like, mathematics needs to come to grips with its misogynist and racist past. And basically any disparities in STEM fields where there's more men than women is a sign of misogyny and racism. So, well, what about all the fields where women have more degrees than men? And no, of course, no one cares about that. That's, again, that counterfactual example. So she did half a dozen of those. Peak wokeness hit with the editorial on Jedi. So the Jedi Knights in Star Wars. So the justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Jedi warriors was the kind of the motto of the social justice warriors, right? They're just Jedi warriors. And so this op-ed rejected that, saying the problem is that the Star Wars characters are white and male, and worst of all, they settle their disputes with phallic laser swords. And I thought, that is as bad as it gets, right? Phallic laser swords. What are they watching on TV anyway?
You know, I guess maybe that's the adult channel of Disney Adult now or something like that. You recently wrote two articles or a two-part series of essays, Why I Am No Longer Woke. And you talked about in the first one, you said, you know, these were from late last year, the beginning of this year, at your Substack, which is available to all for free. You asked for donations, which is fair, for Skeptic, which is published by a nonprofit. Can you discuss why you are no longer woke? And you called yourself woke, so you know.
You're just kind of using John McWhorter's history of the word, which comes from African American community, just being awakened to the injustices in the community, which were real for the longest time. So, nothing wrong with being woke. Woke is a good thing. We should be woke. But that word is now, as John has tracked, has changed dramatically to mean something quite different. So I basically said, I'm not that anymore, because that has now changed.
But you said that you know, because you cared about issues about equality under the law and about equal opportunity and things like that, that you would qualify as woke.
I would think you
are, you know, very tolerant of alternative lifestyles and things like that.
That's a good libertarian way to put it. Yes, I think that's right.
You know,
I mean, we should all be woke in that sense, right? It's sensitive to injustices and so on.
So, you know, how did wokeness, and I think everybody would agree that, you know, over the past 20 years or 25 years, society has become much more attuned to questions, you know, that pulled under the rubric of wokeness, of, you know, are we secretly racist? Are we, you know, do we have cognitive biases that we don't even understand, you know, that are unconscious to us and things like that? Where did that come from?
Well, so I think if you take the long history of civil rights movements, abolition of slavery and torture and so on, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, animal rights, and so on, the big issues have been largely solved, and we're just kind of fine-tuning them here and there. And so I think this is my interpretation of it. Young activists that want to do something. I want to get out there and make the difference. I want to change the world. And so on. What's left? Well, they're mispronouncing people, and I'm going to get out there and march about and microaggressions, and we got to create safe spaces. And so everybody's concerned about, you know, kind of harm reduction-based morality. And threat of harm used to be pretty significant, and now it's not as much anymore. But the moral emotions that people carry are still get ramped up because with the negativity bias, we notice bad things more than good things and so on. So, and it happens slow enough on the decadal level, you don't quite notice it. So college kids today have no idea what it was really like in the 1950s. And they just think, well, it's as bad as it's ever been. Availability heuristic, whatever's on the news. There was a police video of, you know, and so on. And then they lose their minds and they got to go out and march about it and something like that. So I think that's probably what's going on.
Outside of universities, I mean, it's also, you know, it entered corporate America in a pretty big way. And if it's being pushed by young people, like, you know, do they really have that power? Or is it more complex?
No. Wow, do they have the power? Well,
I realize it was a million years ago, but when I was in college, the one thing you knew as a student is that nobody gave a fuck whether you were there or not,
right? So. Yeah. Well, but I do think there's been some other shifts, for example, from equal opportunity to equal outcomes. So from the word equality to the word equity seems to have made that transition, that if we don't have the perfect percentage of representation from each group in the United States in physicians, lawyers, CEOs, Supreme Court justices, or whatever, then the only allowable explanation is discrimination, as opposed to other social science explanations, which can be tested and are probably better.
What would those be?
Oh, the pipeline issue. So you just say, why are there not more women in STEM? Even though now there's a ton of research showing that those early studies of the blinded CVs where they send job applications, the same CV, but it's a woman's name versus a man's name, or an obvious white name versus an obvious black name, and the white male applicants get far more callbacks. Okay, those studies have all failed the replication crisis. Now we know that, in fact, the data show Stephen Cece is the researcher on this. He's done a really good job. Super liberal guy, by the way, I have to say that. showing that, in fact, women in almost every category in academia get tenure sooner. They have as good of qualifications. They get just as many callbacks for jobs and so on and so forth. There isn't a problem. And you would think that liberal activists would celebrate this. Look how far we've come since the 1960s. There's more women physicians than men. There's more women lawyers, whatever But no, it's grimmer than ever.
But you mentioned the pipeline problem.
Okay, yeah, sorry, I forgot about that. Yeah. So it could go back to something like just vocational interest differences in different fields, and that maybe in sixth grade, there's fewer women going in this pathway versus that pathway. Again, we're only talking about this one area, that STEM fields that people seem to care about. So the idea is that if universities are not actually discriminating against women in hiring professors, then what's the problem? Well, there aren't as many applying. Why aren't there as many applying? And you can apply this to people of color or whatever. And then so you can take it all the way back to, well, where were they in high school? What were they doing in middle school? You know, and when they took those vocational interest tests, where did they score? So you have to go all the way back. Mm-hmm. So the pipeline is getting narrower and narrower in some fields.
Yeah. Is, you know, assuming that it's valuable to give all people more options. And there's no question, you know, I'm sure all of us have family members who, you know, are over 60 who... There might have been a bright woman in your family, and they would say, oh, you know, really, you should be a nurse, as opposed to the boy would be, you should be a doctor. How do we help make sure that equal opportunities are actually being done without necessarily going affirmative action and saying, okay, we have to commit to advancing this percentage of people in this field for this reason? But
well, we've already done it. Academia is... They're just falling over themselves to hire people of color and women and so on in STEM fields. That's not the problem. Mm-hmm. And they're not, these are uber liberal professors. I know most of these people, right? They're uber liberal progressives. They're not discriminating consciously. It's unconscious or whatever is mm-hmm. nonsense. But yeah, so it's that cursed horror films problem. We're just focused on the one, just these three or four fields right here where women and people of color are less represented than their percentage. Why aren't we talking about all these other fields? And so they're not applying the same standards. The government already records everybody's race and gender and so on, and is already trying to legislate from the top down.
Yeah.
It just has to come from the bottom up, and we've already done that. Again, Dr. King's, it's largely happened.
You talk about wokeness as being tightly related to a kind of blank slate fallacy that, and you also put it in the context of two people that I think a lot of people here would know, the economist Thomas Sowell and the psychologist Steven Pinker. Thomas Sowell talked about a conflict of visions, the constrained vision, which he identified with conservatives, and the unconstrained vision, which he did with liberals or progressives. Pinker talks about the tragic vision and the utopian vision. And what you say that the progressive side of this equation believes in the blank slate. Can you talk a little bit about that and what? How does that show up again and again?
Well, if you believe that people are inherently equal, not under the law, but actual talent, intelligence, emotional regulation, just personality, temperament, whatever, and we don't have equal outcomes, then the problem has to be in society. And so therefore we can socially engineer it from the top down through legislation and so on. Yeah, but the mountain of evidence, Pinker and Sowell, especially Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, just, it's like 800 pages of evidence that we're not equal. And it's not that one is better than the other or anything like that. And what's wrong with just having different interests in different subjects? You can't force people to go into a profession because some activist just thinks, well, we need 2 more percentage points here in this particular field of mathematics or whatever. But that's what that gets you. And that's what all the experiments that libertarians like to talk about for the last century of socialistic, communistic countries, they're all blank slate models. Those are visions of human nature can be completely engineered. And Pinker shows especially that the opposite is true. If you don't have a recognition that we have inner demons that have to be, changed through culture and laws and so on, then and to bring out the better angels, then you're never going to make progress. And so that's where I think most progress has come.
What do you do to, where does your interest in kind of expanding opportunity to people or having equality before the law, where does that come from? Because that's a philosophical prior, right?
Where does it come from?
You mean? why do you value that?
Just personally, I just think it's a better way to go, but I'm like you, more libertarian-oriented. Yeah. Individual autonomy is the foundation of our moral theory. That's what we begin with, the autonomy of the individual. That's what not the group. But that's pretty rare, actually, in history.
Well, and you wrote a book about that, right?
Yeah, the moral arc, yeah.
And how did things go, how did they go from a more collectivist understanding of humanity and of human value and of morals to the more individualist one?
Well, that's really the Enlightenment and like Jefferson and Hamilton and all these guys that from Locke and Rousseau and the social contract, that the individual is the foundation of a society. Mm-hmm. Even if you argue that the individual should give up some rights to get better, more freedoms or whatever, it's still the individual. Okay, let's just put it so. Harm to individuals. That's our kind of moral starting point. Is somebody harmed by this or not, an individual? Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's conflicting rights. Thomas Sowell always talks about conflicting rights. I've been writing about this a lot recently with the trans issue. Trans rights are human rights. Yeah, okay, don't discriminate against somebody because they're trans. Right. Well, what if a male to female trans wants to enter a female sports? And this is a post-puberty male who is clearly physically dominant over the other women in the sport. Don't the women have a right to compete against other biological women? So you have conflicting rights. You can't have everything. Right. So,
yeah. And you also you make an interesting argument about abortion that's related to that. When I mean, there are, you know, any given situation could have conflicting rights. So, you know, the right of Leah Thomas to swim in women's competitions in college, you know, she has that right, but then it conflicts with other with biological women who want to compete against other biological women.
Yeah.
But you transpose that, I thought, in a really interesting essay about abortion rights, where there are, you know, there can be conflicting sets of rights, and that's part of what society does, is it figures out how do we adjudicate these conflicts in a way that is, you know, most people will agree with. Could you recall your abortion argument?
So I'm a lifelong pro-choice advocate, you know, but I interview and talk to pro-lifers fairly regularly, and, you know, I try to steel man their argument. Okay, what are they arguing here? Why, are they, you know, half the country disagrees with me on this. And, well, they think it's murder. I mean, that is a human being, and you're killing it. Okay, it's certainly something that you're killing. It's a living organism. It's a potential human. It's not a legal person until, I guess, in the law in different states. Like it's a double homicide if a pregnant woman is killed. In California, the Lacey Peterson case, I think that was 8 months pregnant. That counted as a legal person, so it's a double homicide, something like that. But clearly, I think everybody recognizes it's a spectrum, if you will, and that you got to draw the line somewhere, and that's what the law does, although scientists say, well, there's no place to properly draw the line, really. And so you just have to choose the rights of the fetus to live, the rights of the adult woman to choose. Historically speaking, so here's my final twist on the argument. Historically speaking, men have always tried to control women's reproductive choices, always, for thousands of years. And I have a whole discussion of the evolutionary origins of this. You know, mama's baby, dad is daddy's maybe. You know, paternity uncertainty leads men to be hyper vigilant about, mate guarding and so on and so forth. So controlling female sexuality has always been the case, and it's never good for women. So the kind of enlightened liberal tradition should be, well, then we should give women more rights and not go back the other way. Even while recognizing the pro-life argument, yes, it shouldn't just be done casually as a form of birth control. But let's, what's the phrase? The safe, legal, and rare.
I guess before we leave trans women in sports, you tell a story. You were a professional cyclist in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Okay, and you set a record where you drove from the City Hall of San Francisco to the city, or you rode to the City Hall of L.A.?
I did a bunch of crazy things like that.
Yeah, how long? That's like 405 miles or something.
I did it in 20 hours.
Okay.
And change. But by the way, that record has now been broken by a woman, Shauna Hogan.
This is
19. She did it in 19 and a half hours, so hey.
Yeah, and you asked her in one of your stories, you asked her, you know, does she think that, you know, that trans women should compete in female categories? And what was her response?
Yeah, well, so the Race Across America that I did five times, and there was a race director for a decade.
Explain what that is.
That's the transcontinental LA to New York nonstop bike race. Everybody has their own support crew.
So we are just talking with a crazy man.
Yes, I can totally.
It's like, yeah.
I even have a medical condition named after me called Schirmerneck. It's an overuse injury that about a third of long distance cyclists get, and I was the first one to have the luck of getting this, and I actually had to DNF in the 1983 Race Across America in Ohio. I just couldn't go on anymore. My head's just collapsed. The neck muscles completely collapsed, and so now that you could look it up, it's a medical. It's like, I swear, a century from now, Nick, the only thing I'll be remembered for is Schirmerneck. It's like Alzheimer's. Who was that guy again? What did he do? Yeah. So anyway, so we had a men's division and a women's division. And one year, in 1993, Shauna Hogan and another woman named Muffy Ritz, especially Shauna, she was ahead of all of the men all the way into Colorado. We started in Santa Monica. And we thought, oh, my God, a woman could win this race. This would be historic. Great. And then she ended up losing by about a day or so because the men are just stronger. right? So then this went on for a couple more years, and we were talking about maybe we should, maybe this is the sport that could do it. And so I asked Shauna and the other women, do you want just to have a one division? No, because it's not fair. You know, the men are just stronger. And again, it's not, okay, so Shauna beat my record. That's not the point. On average, yes, Serena Williams could beat me in tennis, double bagel every time. I wouldn't even get a point off her. But it's not me that she's playing, right? She wouldn't even get a point off Roger Federer, right? I mean, she herself said she couldn't beat the top 500th placed male tennis player in the world. There'd be no women's tennis at all. The Australian Open's going on right now. There'd be nothing. They'd have no money, no television, nothing if they didn't have a women's division. So it's just on average, after puberty, there's a massive difference. And you just have these overlapping bell curves. But at the far end of professional sports and elite sports, you just have to have, you have to protect those women's rights.
Yeah. In the second part of the essay on why I'm no longer woke is titled Wokeness Poisons Science. Explain how that happens.
Well, so there's so many crazy examples of, you know, like a physicist like Sabine Hofstadter, the German physicist who studies the early universe and inflation. So she posts on Twitter, I applied for a grant for my research, and it got kicked back and said, how is this research going to help people of color? And so she basically on Twitter says, what do I plug in here? What's the magic words, right? I mean, and there's like thousands of examples like that. You know, the DEI programs, these statements that are essentially loyalty statements that professors have to issue now.
Which have been rolled back, right, in a lot
some,
of places.
In some places, yeah. Yes. Yeah, we can talk about it if you want. You know, what's the right way to push back against that? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of professors. I was just at this conference at USC last weekend, Censorship in Science. Yep. You know, so the FIRE people were there, Greg Lukianoff, the Heterodox Academy. But I mean, there was maybe 100 people, you know, and how many college academic professors are there? Like, 100,000 or something? I mean, it's huge. And they feel like we've lost this battle. We push back, but I can't get anybody on my campus to speak up with me, you know, and because they're all afraid to lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have tenure, nobody speaks up.
Well, we started off by kind of agreeing that it seems like the high watermark of wokeness, you know, has reached, and it's the tide's going out a little bit. I mean, do you think that's true? And if so, then you know why? And how do you accelerate that? Assuming that, you know, wokeness is bad, particularly in things like science or at the academy, where you're really supposed to go where the ideas take you, and not make sure that, you know, before you say anything, it's in line with some pre-existing orthodoxy.
I probably opt on the over-optimism bias. I've been saying for the last 5 years, this tide is going to turn, that pendulum is going to swing back. And my friends are like, when's it swinging back? Here's another example. Another. I do think that there's a lot of data, survey data now showing that the vast majority of Americans are not at all on board with any of the far woke stuff. And as we saw in the election, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably overdetermined the number of explanations for what happened in 2024, but one of which, to explain the Democrats' loss, is this overemphasis on wokeness. That, you know, it's like Bill Maher's been hammering on this every week on his show, that I'm a liberal, I'm a Democrat, we got to stop this. This is crazy. We're going to lose more elections. That's part of it, I think. And so I think a course correction is in order. Also, one last thing. The surveys also show that very few even academics are actually on board with this, but they're silenced, either through cancel culture, but there's this phenomenon called pluralistic ignorance or the spiral of silence, where everybody thinks everybody else believes something, when in fact most people don't believe it. The classic study on this is binge drinking in college. Yes, individual college students, do you like binge drinking? No, it's terrible. But I know everybody else loves it, so I do it, right? So then the moment you tell everybody, you know, actually nobody likes doing this. Oh, okay. Then people can
binge drinking may be the one thing that's not true about. But it's like,
maybe.
I think I get the concept, yeah.
So I think if enough people speak out, and then everybody else can feel free to speak out, if there's no punishment. You know, so you got to end the cancel culture. So is denouncing cancel culture.
I mean, in terms of censorship in science, is the biggest issue You know, is it individual kind of lack of character, which might be unfair, but, you know, why aren't there more Galileos, right? Who also kind of, you know, finagled his, you know, he knew when to pull back, right, from his statements of this is absolutely true. But, you know, is it an individual problem? Is it the institutions, like at the university level? Is it the, you know, National Institutes of Health? I mean, you know, the pandemic is in the back, in the rearview mirror, but there was enormous, you know, governmental, institutional energy saying this is what we're going to be doing. This is the right way to understand COVID. And we don't want to fund things that are going to go in another direction. Or somebody like a Matt Ridley, who started talking about the, you know, the origins, you know, coming from a lab leak rather than a wet market, you know, faced a lot of issues. Jay Bhattacharya, who's been nominated for a administrative post by Donald Trump, faced this. Is it, you know, where is the censorship coming from?
Well, both institutions and individuals, certainly I think the people in leadership roles in academia mostly believe the woke ideology, but there's not that many of them. And then I think the people under them who don't believe it just keep their mouths shut. Right, Jay Bhattacharya, okay, the fringe epidemiologist. Right. Even that, you know, Fauci accused him of being a fringe. Now it's a joke. He has a T-shirt. He has a business card that says fringe epidemic, you know. And so if we make fun of it, like, that helps. Then other people could see, oh, all right, you know, this has gone too far, something like that. But in the corruption in science, I mean, I made the joke about the, you know, the Sabina Hoffsetfelder's Twitter, but the squelching and silencing of findings from scientific studies that are not politically correct or might make people feel uncomfortable is a real thing. This really does happen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of scientific journals now actually have like statements. You know, if you submit something that could be offensive to a group, then we won't publish it. I mean, they just say it right there in print. Mm-hmm. And so now that we have the Journal of Controversial Ideas that says we're not going to do that, right? We have the University of Austin. We, you know, the Peterson Academy. I mean, there's market solutions to this.
I'm hoping, yeah, the Journal of Controversial Ideas, like they put in offensive remarks. They put in like old Red Fox routines in the middle of stuff. Is that the best way around? I mean, if you know, when somebody like Steven Pinker talks about, you know, here are five steps to reform Harvard and higher education, that's part of it, right? Working within the system, but then how important is it to build parallel or alternative institutions that are like, hey, you know what? Yeah, keep doing what you're doing. We're going out here and we're going to have some fun on the frontier.
Yeah, well, I like, again, the libertarian solution is just build your own institutions that don't do that. University of Austin being the case study there. I mean, someone like Steve's not going to run off and start a new university. He's at Harvard, but he can reform it from within because he's got 10. He's not going anywhere. He can't be canceled. So he can stand up and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And what's anybody going to do?
No.
They can't do anything, right? And now he's got a couple dozen.
I guess they can go to Yale.
I don't know. Go to Yale.
To go back to the Trump phenomenon here, another person that he's appointed or, you know, wants to have as his Health and Human Services secretary is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is kind of interesting, right? In the sense like he wants to do, or he's called out for, you know, real change in the way that the FDA operates and, you know, what drugs the DEA says are allowable and aren't and things like that. He also believes in every possible conspiracy theory. I mean, he would be watching every horror movie and being like, yes, yes, every quadrant, there's a million conspiracies.
Yeah.
How do you make sense of, from a policy point of view, is what's necessary for policy change to have people who might be a little bit nuts, but are just like, fuck it, I'm changing the culture here? Or does that discredit the idea that, like, we need to get back to what science or what, you know, rational discourse is supposed to be about?
Yeah, the thing that bothers me about RFKJ is that he does make some good points, But then he goes off the deep end. And so anybody that watches, if you watch him on Rogan long enough, it's like, oh, my God. This. So the first things he said, you know, like the regulatory capture by Big Pharma. That's real. That really happened. I mean, they just bribed regulators, Purdue Pharmaceutical and the Sackler family. They just paid people off to get their drugs through testing and so on. And they knew they were addictive. And so that's true. That's, you know, that has to be stopped. And then the stuff about diet, you know, American diet is pretty bad. I mean, this is pretty clear now why we have an obesity problem. So all that stuff is good. You know, but then an hour later, you know, the CIA shot my dad and you know, the lizard aliens and I don't know what. You know, he's off and running. And then you listen to that and you're like, oh, well, forget the diet stuff then. That's the problem. So we have to stay focused on what's true throughout everything, not just like, here's some good things. And then I also have these other crazy ideas I want to talk about. I thought it was okay, by the way, on the censorship thing. I thought it was okay. He was on Rogan. People were complaining that Rogan had him on there. He'll talk to anybody about anything and believe whatever the last thing somebody told him. And okay, that's what you're getting with Joe Rogan. You're not getting 60 Minutes with a team of researchers that are going to put the hard questions. He's just talking to people. That's okay.
Have you been on Rogan?
I've been on, yeah, 7 times.
Okay. Yeah, okay. But probably never again.
I don't know. The last time I was on with conspiracy theories, he was not happy about the JFK stuff because I'm lone assassin. That's it. Not 100%. 99.9%.
And that assassin is named Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah,
right?
That's the guy. Yeah, so that's the guy. Yeah. he did it. Yeah.
I want to talk about that a little bit in depth because the JFK assassination is kind of paradigmatic of conspiracy thinking, particularly in any of our lifetimes. But first, you talk about the main thesis of conspiracy, the book, which is why the rational believe the irrational. You talk about conspiracism as being a kind of rational response to a world that is incredibly complicated and, you know, and bizarre. Can you talk a little bit what you mean about conspiracism and why we, you know, conspiracy-like thinking kind of makes sense?
There's an underlying rationality in that the world's a dangerous place, and people really do conspire to do things against other people. The very definition of two or more people in secret plotting to do something to a third person or agency that's illegal or immoral. This happens all the time, right? I mean, Volkswagen is conspiring to cheat the regulatory state in Europe for its emission standards. That happened. Watergate, Iran-Contra.
Again, not to make it a little too boomer centric for everybody, but I mean, you talk about when the Church Committee came out with its findings in the mid 70s, and this is after Watergate and after Vietnam and after a lot of lies. You know, they brought the receipts and they showed things like MK Ultra, the CIA's attempt to, you know, use psychedelics to, you know, create mind control drugs. And it was in, you know, like nobody would buy this if it was fiction, right? We know that conspiracies are happening all the time.
MK Ultra is the fascinating one. The guy who ran that program burned all the papers after he left. And so we don't have much of a paper trail, but there's enough. Clearly, the CIA was doing this. And then there was COINTELPRO, which only happened with a break-in to an FBI office by some hippies back in the day.
A couple of professors from Temple and Swarthmore.
Yes, that's right.
So it was like these pipe-smoking, you know, turtleneck-wearing hippie professors who broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. And that's why we know that there was a massive program to infiltrate and kind of provoke all types of anti-war, civil rights, even right-wing groups into violent
action. Right, yeah. So half the people in an audience like this, if we were having a civil rights movement, would be the members of the FBI.
Right.
And maybe they do a few things to instigate violence, and then the group gets some bad coverage, and that makes us all look bad. That actually happened. You know, the worst case, of course, was the blackmail letter to Martin Luther King Jr. It's on his webpage. You can read it or just go on our MK Ultra or just MLK's Wikipedia page. And there's the letter. signed off by J. Edgar Hoover. We will, we have your sex, basically they made sex tapes. And this would be, you know, porn, revenge, something like that, which is illegal. But they did that. We're going to make these tapes public if you don't stop what you're doing. And they even kind of hinted, if you read between the lines, you should kill yourself.
Right.
Our government did that to U.S. citizens protected by the Constitution a lot. Not to mention the foreign, you know, assassination of foreign leaders, rigging elections. Oh, the CIA knows all about how to rig elections. They used to do it all the time in South American countries where, you know, they had a fascist dictatorship and a communist dictator. And, you know, the fascist dictators, at least you can do business with them. You know, they'll let our companies come in and do business. We just bribe them. Communists will just nationalize our company. So let's, that happened.
Michael, would you make porn to win the Cold War?
We already won the Cold War, so I'm off.
Okay. All right. Okay. But would you make porn to start a new Cold War? To lose a Cold War. So let's talk about JFK, though, because, you know, your summation of, you know, I mean, there are probably more books written about the JFK assassination than virtually any other topic. How many of you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin of John F. Kennedy? Okay, like,
wow,
and yeah, and you know, maybe a little bit less than half. How many of you believe that he either was not involved at all in the assassination, which some people have, or that, you know, there was a vast conspiracy involving any number of other organizations?
Or he was a patsy?
Yeah. Yes.
No.
Oh, no.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
Good skeptical group.
One or two. Okay. So maybe, yeah. So how, you know, How do you know for sure that, you know, it was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, nobody knows for sure. I mean, he's dead, okay. Right? So he didn't even get a trial. He had a mock trial where Vincent Bugliosi went up against Jerry Spence and a British court, mock court for the BBC, and won handily, that proved that to the jury that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Okay, for what that's worth. but the thing is that in any event, if you look closely enough at the details, there's always going to be unexplained anomalies. You know, how do you explain that one weird thing right there? Right? And so because the JFK thing looms so large, everybody's picked apart the Zapruder film, for example. Why is that guy in the grassy area from where Abraham Zapruder was filming this direction? There's a guy there with an umbrella. It turns out
it was a sunny day. Why is he there with an umbrella?
Day,
it doesn't
and
make
the,
any
the,
sense.
Just as the motorcade was going by, he opens his umbrella. Oh, the umbrella must have actually been a gun, like a rifle, or it was a signal to the shooters to go ahead and now take the shot, who were planted in the grassy knoll and the picket fence and all that stuff, right? And so this guy, actually, they tracked him down. Finally, he came forward like 20 years after the fact saying, I'm the umbrella guy. And it was a protest against the Kennedy family that goes back to Neville Chamberlain, with his umbrella saying, I appeased Hitler and everything is going to be great. And so, and JFK's father, who was kind of...
it was the ambassador to the court.
So it was all wrapped up in that. He goes, I just came out to protest with my umbrella. I'm not the shooter.
So was he happy that JFK got shot?
I don't know. No, I don't think anybody asked him that.
Yeah.
Earl Morris did a film on like an 8-minute film. Yeah, that's great. So, but the point is, like with 9/11, you can pick apart just, you know, what's that puff of smoke there? And somebody found a passport that was, you know, way downtown and this and that. If you look close enough, you'll find weird things. So it doesn't mean anything.
How then do you, I mean, what, you know, and obviously you need to look at each one in particular, but what is the, you know, what's the guiding light? You know, what's the astrolab that you use to make sure that you are not getting suckered into a conspiracy theory, as opposed to not wanting to face the horrible truth that not only did this terrible thing happen, but that it was actually planned?
Well, yeah, so that's an interesting way to put it, because the bias there is called a proportionality bias, that the size of the effect should have an equally sized big cause. So, you know, 9/11 was a massive event caused by 19 guys with box cutters? Really? Seriously? You're telling me that? Or, you know, JFK, the famous, powerful person in the world. By who? Lee Harvey Oswald, some lone nut? You know, Princess Diana, you know, cause of death, drunk driving, speeding, no seatbelt. Happens all the time. Right? But it's Princess Diana. Come on. That can't be right. She's big, important, and beautiful. It's got to be, you know, the MI5 and the royal family and this and that. And so that's what's going on there, I think. If it was the mayor of Dallas who was assassinated, would anybody care? No. It'd be like, oh, yeah, he was a nut. The lone shooter nuts all the time. So is there a convergence of evidence towards somebody else, right? If this is what I asked Oliver Stone when he was on my podcast. You know, so there's mountains of evidence against Lee Harvey Oswald. Who else? Name. Well, the CIA. Who in the CIA? Name names. Who was the guy actually there? Where's the paper trail? There must have been some receipts of what they paid them. You know, bank transfers or somebody of the thousands of people that would have to have been involved wants to come forward and talk about it. Not one person. And then in the form of negative evidence, you know, WikiLeaks and all the, millions of classified documents that were illegally leaked. Not one document in there about JFK being part of a FBI or CIA. And by the way, nothing about the fake moon landing, nothing about the aliens in Area 51.
So you agree it is fake, though, right? Yes. You called it the fake moon
landing. Yes, right, yeah.
Very quickly, it was only a couple of weeks ago that those of us who live in the New York area were talking constantly about a bunch of UFOs in New Jersey.
Yeah, what happened to those?
You know, and they had visited before in the 30s, in Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. Explain that phenomenon of like where, and you talk about UFOs because in 1947, the first sighting of what became known as a UFO happened, and there was a spate of sightings, and then they kind of disappeared, then they come back. What's going on when we see, a bunch of UFOs showing up all out of the blue?
Well, so in that case, the New Jersey ones, we're pretty sure was a kind of a mass hysteria, social contagion sort of thing. Because there are a lot of things in the atmosphere that most people never notice until you see a news story like, oh, there's some weird things in the sky. Then everybody goes out, oh, I just saw something weird. Right? A lot of them turn out to be Elon's satellites. You know, when they launch these satellites now, the little tiny ones, they're released in a string of satellites. So they're just like every 100 meters or so they release them. And then they slowly pull apart as they circle. So I saw, because I live in Santa Barbara just below Vandenberg Air Force Base where they launch these. And I've seen them go over my house. Just, there's like a string of them. You know, if I didn't know, I'd think, whoa, okay. And so, if I don't know, then there must be something spooky. That's the idea. And so I'm always amazed at how many people don't know what Venus looks like. It is really bright. And I'll be walking with friends or whatever. Like, hey, there's Venus tonight. How do you know that's Venus? Because it was Venus last night. I mean, don't you know? I mean, the moon, Venus, Jupiter's the other bright one. People go, how do you know that's, oh my God, that's Jupiter. How do you know that's Jupiter? Because it was there, you know. Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't know that. Satellites and even the famous Jimmy Carter UFO that finally got tracked down of that it was a rocket launch. Because they always said, oh, he mistook Venus. That isn't it. He knew something about astronomy. That it was a rocket launch because he described the colors as it was moving away, the colors that it was releasing. And these were different stages of the rocket launch, turns out. And they even had, because he had the date when he saw it, and they even tracked down the actual launch.
No.
Anyway, so that's it. It's just, people noticing.
Are we in a kind of golden age of conspiracy thinking? It seems, there are right-wing versions of things like, QAnon has faded, whether it comes back, who knows. But, there's a lot of, every election that Donald Trump is in is a vast conspiracy. Even when he wins, usually he's like,
too big,
something's not right here.
Yeah.
And then on the left, there's tons of conspiracy theories about, these dark shadowy forces that are dictating everything. And it could be the Russian government or Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook, throwing the election, et cetera, or, billionaires dictating everything. Is it worse than it usually is, or are we just, you know,
so there's talking about there's some survey data on this and some social science research on like letters to the New York Times over the last century, and it isn't worse now. I mean, people were writing to the editor of the New York Times in like the 1910s, worried about the Catholics. You know what those Catholics are up to, you know. And then of course always the Jews in the 1920s and 30s. You know what the Jews are up to, and the immigrants, that's an old one. So those have always been around. It probably goes back thousands of years. It's the speed and the depth at which the ideas can spread overnight. And this started with a little homemade film called Loose Change, which was made in 2003 by a couple of college kids that thought, I'm just going to ask some interesting questions about 9/11. That's what it's about, 9/11. You know, this actually is an expression, just asking questions. So we call it jacking off. He's just asking questions. And these are the people. So I'm not saying I know that who did it. I'm just wondering, how do you explain that Lee Harvey Oswald did this and that, and he knew this guy, and so on. And that was when it really took off. That had like 40 million views. I mean, Hollywood producers would die for numbers like this, right? And it was just a free film online. And so that's where it really launched. Because the JFK assassination, people have been around since really it happened. But they were small in number.
Well,
the
best ones were around before it happened, right?
Yes, that's
right.
Because
they knew it was going to happen, right?
The psychics.
So, yeah.
But they had these little mimeograph newsletters, and they'd meet in hotel rooms with 10 people. There's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. Right, some of them published books, but mostly self-published books. But now you can have millions of followers overnight. So it's the speed and the depth that's different.
And the best kind of inoculation against it is, you know, it's partly kind of doing rational exercises, like the preponderance of evidence and and checking your sources and data. How much of it is also, you know, just kind of understanding history and recognizing that certain kinds of themes and stories that have, you know, they encode some kind of symbolic or psychological truth. We want this to have been planned. We want, you know, it's better to live in a world that is horrible, that is evil, but controlled than one that is just indifferent and completely random. How important is it to know history as a kind of hedge against conspiracy thinking along with rationality?
Well, the psychology there is that our brains are wired to find patterns and look for causal explanations of things, not very well wired for understanding randomness, chance, highly improbable events will happen a lot if there's a lot of things going on. You know, we're not tuned for that. So I have examples of this that I use in the book, like when Steve Jobs released the iPod, remember the iPod? And then they introduced the random shuffle feature. And customers complained, my song list is not random because some songs keep coming up over and over and others hardly ever get played. That's random. It's clusters. Mm. Right? Gamblers, you know, think that a proper flip of the coin or red, black on the roulette, it should be just, you know, red, black, heads, tails. But in fact, they cluster. You'll get four or five heads in a row and then six or seven tails in a row. This happens all the time. So randomness, mostly life is random. Mostly no one knows what's going on. But then we just immediately impose pattern on it. And the last element to that is it's kind of scary to think no one's in charge. You mean just shit just happens? Yeah. But I want something behind the curtain that I can pull back and go, there it is. Now I feel like I have some control over elements that happen in life. I think that's really what's going on.
All right, we're going to end our conversation there. Please give a big round of applause for Michael Shermer.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, everybody.
Okay.